Hello, this is Signals from the Hill, a podcast about comics from Avery Hill Publishing. I'm Ricky Miller, co-publisher at Avery Hill. In this episode, we've got an interview with the comics creator, multimedia artist, and Shakespeare aficionado, Briggs, as we celebrate the release of her new graphic novel adaptation of Macbeth. She began her comic-making career while pursuing her master's at Duncan of Jordanstone College of Art with a feminist reimagining of the archetypal hero story, Story Cycle. Their adaptation of Macbeth, Act 1, Scene 1, won the inaugural Elsinore Award for Graphic Shakespeare in 2016. A fixture of the Scottish independent comic scene, Briggs founded and ran the Ex Libris Book Fair, Dundee's only independent book fair. Her work has been exhibited in both art galleries and colleges in Sweden, Scotland, Japan, and the United States. Her adaptation of Macbeth is the only graphic novel I know of that utilizes the full Shakespeare text. If you know anyone who is either studying it or is in the play, I'd recommend it as a gift to aid their understanding of the work. It's both an amazing academic accomplishment and a stunning work of art. Firstly, though, here's what's going on in the world of Avery Hill at the moment. The aforementioned Macbeth came out a few weeks ago. You can pick it up from all good bookstores and from our online store right now. We've also had our next three books go to the printer, and the complete work Wilderness by Claire Scully is out next month, and then Curses by George Wilesole and The Hard Switch by Owen D. Pomery come out in October. We're also going to be announcing our early 2024 releases very soon, so stay tuned to our social media or sign up for our mailing list for more on that. You can get us at averyhillpublishing.com. Now, here's that interview with Briggs. Hi, Briggs. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Well, where are you now while we're recording this?
I'm in my studio in my house. I know my background is extremely boring. All of my interesting stuff is on this wall. And I live just outside Philadelphia.
Okay. Tell us about your neighborhood. What kind of area is it that you live in?
Sure. All right. So I live in a town called Phoenixville. It's very cute and sweet. It's just a little town, but with actually like a town center. It's full of breweries. If you like craft beer, you can stay in the spare room if you want.
Perfect. That sounds
Yeah.
great. Yep.
Yeah.
For a couple of months or something.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. If my baby comes looking for me, you haven't seen me. So,
Okay, that's fair.
and is that where you grew up, or have you
Yeah, I
moved
grew
there?
up not too far from here. I grew up sort of just down the road. Funnily enough, made my way back here after a circuitous route. But yeah, my partner and I both grew up around here. We met in high school. We met when we were like 14. Yeah, so, yeah, ended up right back where we started.
And what kind of childhood was that? Was that you growing up going, were you like a kid in playing in the street, or were you in your room drawing, or?
Oh yeah, so it's very suburban growing up, but I was like a 90s latchkey kid, so it was a lot of like hanging out by myself watching all of the amazing 90s cartoons that were coming out this at that time, like Batman the Animated Series, like kind of made a severe and lasting impression on my brain.
I'm so jealous of that because I missed Batman the Animated Series and the X-Men cartoon. Like I was a bit too old, I think. I think they probably came out like end of the 90s or something. So, and I think maybe they weren't on the right channels for me in the UK as
Okay.
well. So like yeah, I never saw any of those, and I don't think you can. I don't even know where you can watch Batman the Animated Series. So I don't know. I don't think it's on any streaming sites over here either.
Yeah, I think I saw it. It was on, well, over here. I think it was on HBO Max for a bit. I don't
Right.
know if it's still on there.
Yeah, I'm very
Yeah.
jealous of those. 'Cause we I was more 80s cartoons, so it was a
Okay.
different kettle of fish, but still good, obviously. But yeah,
Yeah.
different. And were you drawing at that age?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was drawing and writing a lot. Yeah, I can't even remember. I think a lot of it I was writing my own stories and then doing the illustrations for them. And they were always epic fantasy adventures. You know, all of them like had a strong horse element. There was a big horse girl.
Could you draw horses?
Oh yeah.
Were you
oh,
once
yeah.
ahead of the game already?
Yep. Okay. Yep. I can still draw horses, touch wood in case it gets snatched away from me. Yeah. Notebooks full of horses. And then there was like my horse girl friend where we had like one notebook where we would like trade it back and forth, you know, like I'll draw a horse and this is the horse's name and like his personality traits and then give it to her and she draws enough, you know, like, yeah, a lot of horses.
And were you drawing Batman from the animated
No,
series? I'd
no, I
love to see
don't.
your Batman.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I don't like, I don't know why I feel so, I've never really done a lot of fan art. And like every time I put a toe in, I just feel so much like trepidation. I'm not sure exactly why. Like recently I tried like a Swamp Thing and a Constantine and I was like, okay, this works, but I've never tried to draw a Batman, which
I
is
think
weird.
medieval Batman is crying out for it.
Calling. Yeah, calling for it. Yeah. I mean, I can absolutely see it. The all those strange medieval illustrations of demons and devils. It just makes perfect sense.
Perfect, perfect. And did you read comics as a kid?
Yeah, I got into it a bit later. So I got into it when I was a teen, and one because there wasn't like a comic shop around where I grew up. But I went to sleepaway camp as a young teen, and a girl that I had a massive crush on brought the Sandman with her to sleepaway camp.
Wow,
So
that is pretty
yeah.
cool. How old was that?
How old was I? I can't remember. I want to say like maybe 12 or 13.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't even think I was reading Sandman at 12 and 13.
I
That's
mean,
very
it was
cool.
like, I mean, it was obviously when you have a crush on someone and they're like, oh, I like this comic. And you're like, I like that comic. I'll read it. And yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's pretty formative. If you're reading Sandman at 12 or 13, that's definitely going to influence you going
Right.
forward. Yeah.
Yeah, and it did. It did, absolutely.
And
Yeah.
so would you say that was the kind of comic that sparked you and made you a comics fan, or was there a particular comic which has kind of been that one? Yeah.
I think that one really, I think for, I mean, for a lot of people, it was like just an aha moment of like, I always thought of comics as like, you know, capes and spandex and stuff like that. I love Batman, but yeah. And it was like, oh my gosh, this is about mythology. This is about stories. This is about all of the things that I love and like I'm a bit obsessed with. You can do that. One of those moments.
Yeah.
Like comics can be anything. Yeah.
Absolutely. Have you checked out the Sandman TV show or the Audible version?
Did I watch it? I did watch the Sandman. Like it's funny because like my relationship with Gaiman is like it was so formative. And so intense. And then as I got older, I got more and more annoyed with him, or like I got more and more like, oh, I don't like this, or I felt like a bit cringy about it or something like that.
The work
And then
or him?
the work, yeah.
Yeah.
The work. And like and it's almost like this really intense relationship that I have with Gaiman now. It's like, you know, if somebody breaks your heart, like a film in love with him so hard as an early teen, and then like as I got older was like, oh this could be cool but it's not, like I got so frustrated with him. And now like I did, so to answer your question, I did watch the Netflix show, and I was like just having all those feelings about like, I don't know, it was a very complicated experience for me. Just like this absolutely set me on a path as a child, and I'm seeing this as an adult, and like, yeah, it feels much different and like crisis, existential crisis.
Yeah, I can deeply empathize with that. I'm pretty sure I've had that. I'm trying to dredge up experiences. I mean, my one would probably be Morrissey, but it's not, again, it's not the work so much as the
the man.
person. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely tough when someone lives inside your head so much.
Yeah.
And then yeah, they do something where you just go, oh, actually, that's twisted everything that I felt I liked. Makes me feel really bad.
Yeah, it makes you feel bad and mad and angry. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, just before we go on to the next bit, I would say that the Audible version of Sandman is excellent. Absolutely excellent. Basically, it's Gaiman kind of reading the scripts, essentially, and James McAvoy being Dream, and they essentially do the whole thing, but the scripts with sound effects and stuff, it's actually genuinely brilliant.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, even better than the show, but they're different things. But
yeah,
if you ever wanted to dive deeply back into it, because it is pretty much the same as reading the books, but without the art, it's it's worth a go. So what we're going to do now is that I want to try something a bit different with this podcast for the usual kind of interview, origin story and all that kind of stuff. And it's been something I've been trying to do for a while, and which is talking about comics in the context of wider media, and just the idea that we as creators get influenced by lots of other things other than comics, especially I think in comics, because a lot of comics creators don't read that many comics, I find, and especially didn't read them when they were young and tended to come to them from more of an illustration background. So I'm kind of, you're up for talking about this kind of stuff. So what I did was I gave you a list of things to produce, which was a film, a piece of music, a book, a comic, and a TV show that had an influence on your work. And we're going to go through and discuss those and talk about that other piece of art and why you like that and what it is that you feel that you've brought from that into what you do, which I think should be revealing in a different way about people's work, but I don't know, maybe it won't work, but at the end of the day we can talk about some stuff we like, so
sure. And who doesn't like that?
Just before we jump into that, can I ask about your process and whether you actually consume any other media while you're working? So like, if you're, do you watch while you're like, watch, I don't know, TV shows while you're inking, or do you listen to music while you write and stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it just kind of depends on the process that needs to happen. If it's writing, but other than that, I like a lot of podcasts about terrible things.
So what, crime or just?
Yep, crimes and cults and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I listen to a lot of those, and I also listen to history podcasts about European history mostly, which ends up being a lot also of crime and murder and cults and stuff like that.
That's how they get in charge. Yep.
Right. Yes, exactly. What else do I like to listen to? It's mostly the true crime. It's mostly the podcast. It's mostly nonfiction while I'm writing and arting. Yeah.
And do you watch anything? Because I'm kind of in awe of the people who can like watch something while they're coloring or something.
Only sometimes, and usually if I've seen it before, then I'll watch it.
I don't have to
pay full attention.
Nothing with subtitles.
No, nothing with subtitles.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So the first thing we're going to discuss is a film that has influenced you and bled into your work. And you gave me a few examples of these. Do you want to read them out? Have you got them in front of you? Or do you want me
to? I do. So I think I grew up in the 80s. And The NeverEnding Story was my favorite movie. Still one of my favorite movies. And, you know, back in the day, we had a small selection of VHSs at home that we could watch. That was one of them. I feel like I watched it like until I wore out the VHS. That certain flavor genre of 80s fantasy movies for children that include like The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth and kind of Willow as well, even though that terrified me as a child.
Those terrified me.
Right. Those are serious films for children.
They're just wrong. They just shouldn't be given to children.
Right. no lasting effects on us at all, I'm sure. But like all of those really set me off on this, like I was a kid that just like daydreamed and imagined and made up stories and made up different worlds. But the film that sort of, it was like my first answer, best answer, was the Baz Luhrmann Romeo and Juliet from 1996.
Okay.
That was a near spiritual experience. I was 13 when that came out, which is like the perfect time for that movie to ruin your life and just take it over. And like, I like vividly remember going to the theater with my pack of friends, and it was sold out and we couldn't sit next to each other. And I had to sit next to a strange, you know, other, again, teenage girl. And we didn't know each other, but by the end of the film, we're like crying on each other and like hugging each, you know, like it was such an intense moment. And sort of like validated all of this like Shakespearean love that I already had. And it just became my personality for like the rest of the school year.
So that wasn't your discovery of Shakespeare. You were kind of already there.
Yeah, I was already there. I'd already been like doing plays and stuff in school. Had already been like intrigued and interested. And then it was like somebody came through and made it cool. Like, I'm cool too. Not only am I cool, but like I knew about Shakespeare before all of you posers.
So I watched 10 Things I Hate About You quite recently. Rewatched, obviously, because I've seen it a few times. And yeah, the Shakespeare girl in that made me think of you, definitely. And I was like, oh, I wonder if it was like that. Or was it more a gothy version?
Well, my sister will never, ever let me live down. I went out to the thrift store. I bought a men's pinstripe button-up business shirt. I cut the sleeves so that and added fabric so that they were bell sleeves.
Nice.
And then I wrote with Sharpie on the shirt all of my favorite lines from Romeo and Juliet and would wear that around.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah. And if you were the younger sibling to that nonsense, you would never let me live that down either.
Is that your favorite adaptation of Shakespeare?
I think so. It's almost like I want to say yes, like not because I think it's the best, but because of the personal attachment and the moment when that film hit my squishy brain. I think my favorite is Throne of Blood.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kurosawa.
Kurosawa's Macbeth. Yeah.
Cool.
But that's also a Toshirô Mifune thing.
Yeah.
Sees the best.
Yeah. Absolutely. One when I was kind of looking at your answers, I was kind of more focusing on the kind of 80s movies, and it made me think about the contrast between the humans and the puppetry in those puppetry. I was kind of, I mean, there's a lot of contrast that you use in your work, and I was just wondering if there was anything kind of formative there, where there's kind of those kind of merging together in a very kind of dark and interesting way.
Yeah, I think for like The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, like Brian Froud is absolutely like a big influence as an illustrator and as a designer for all those puppets. Like the worlds that he creates are very tattered and like worn and full of like little details that have been like stitched together haphazardly. And I feel like that's, I do that a lot too in my work.
Kind of faded glamour to a lot of the costumes. Almost dirty glamour, I guess.
And you're right, like all the humans interacting with this glamorous but faded but nonsensical environment, that's really appealing to me.
Absolutely. Okay, and then the next thing that we wanted to discuss was a piece of music, album, or song. So what did you choose for this?
This was interesting because, you know, this music that I listen to in the car, this music that I listen to when I'm working, but what piece of music like influenced me creatively is a very interesting question. So again, like my first answer, best answer was Hildegard von Bingen, a recording. And it's the Canticles of Ecstasy, I think, was the one that I sent you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's a recording of Hildegard von Bingen's choral music that she wrote back in the 12th century. And she was an abbess and a theologian and an herbalist, an artist, and a visionary. And she also composed music, and it's just otherworldly. Like, you listen to it?
Yeah, I listened to it yesterday. Yeah, and it was beautiful, actually. Yeah, I loved it. I mean, I'm kind of open to that kind of thing anyway. So, I really, really liked it. So, and obviously, you have a big interest in medieval art and culture and stuff, I guess. So, yeah. Are you like academically interested in this piece of work, or is it more aesthetics?
I encountered, I only learned about Hildegard because I took a class during my undergrad. It was like I needed to fulfill some sort of elective requirement. So I randomly picked medieval women's literature.
Okay.
And I was like, that whole course just sort of changed my life, basically. And we were like, the professor played part of that like in the class. And I just remember like hearing it for the first time and being like, I don't know where or when I am. I'm just transported to a different place. So I don't know if I would say academically, but maybe obsessively. And part of doing Macbeth this way was like, maybe I can exercise my obsession with medieval art. And the answer is no, like I haven't. I'm actually like, the book next to me that I'm reading for fun is about like these medieval sisters who were queens, and like it's not out of my system.
I was actually talking to a group of librarians today, which is the kind of thing you do in my job. And
that's awesome.
I don't know if you know Karen Green, but she's the comics curator at New York Public mm-hmm. Library, but also she's curates the medieval art. So she's an expert on medieval art. So I kind of mentioned you to her, and she said, yeah, that she's has the Macbeth and she's loved it, and she
awesome.
Went out and bought the rest of your work after she read it as well. So
that's so nice.
I don't think there could be a better person to give you praise for it than that, actually.
No, or like any librarian.
Yeah,
like librarian is like the highest praise to me, honestly. Like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Can I tell you my medieval music joke?
Yes, please.
Okay. I wanted to become a Gregorian monk, but I never got the chance.
Oh. Yeah, okay, you
That's
are
good,
a
isn't
father.
it?
So.
It's good. I'll move on.
Okay.
I actually got that from Alexa. Can you believe it? That was an Alexa joke. Yeah. And it's the only one that's made me laugh. And I laugh about it quite a lot. Okay, we're now going to go to the book you chose.
Yeah. I picked, so there was an obvious choice, which is The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell. Mm-hmm. That book was like the foundation of my master's project, master's study, which was the first time that I ever made a comic. And I made a comic because I was looking at the hero archetype and was like, okay, this is where the hero archetype lives. Contemporary society, so I should make a comic book or like a comic. And it was like, this is it. Like, comics, this is amazing. I don't want to go back to just making paintings, single paintings that live on one person's wall and cost that person a lot of money. I just want to make comic books now. this is amazing. So I mean, it started with this like interest in archetypes and mythology and heroes, and ended up with making comics. And then the other books, I mean, I sort of listed off a few because it's hard to pick one.
Sure.
I really love basically like classics, classical literature, and also like, but more importantly, like retellings of classical stories, like Circe and the Song of Achilles and Lavinia. Finished that by Ursula K. Le Guin. And there's a new translation of The Odyssey by Emily Wilson. He's a professor in Philadelphia, actually. And I just love, basically, it feels like hiding in prehistory, like taking refuge in prehistory and just like hanging out there before things got messed up or something, basically.
They were pretty messed up back then.
They were messed up back then, yes, but you know.
Those gods, I mean.
My little, like, yeah, escapist brain. It's like, yes, back in the, where everything was misty and there was connections to nature and deities could just pop down and mess up your life and stuff like that. And you were one with nature and stuff, like, I yearn.
Yeah, I mean, Circe is one of my favorite books of all time. I mean, that, I liked Song of Achilles, but Circe was one that kind of blew me away, and it's just like incredible, I think.
Yeah.
I did my master's thesis on Odysseus, so basically anything with Odysseus kind of speaks to me quite a lot. I haven't checked out that new version of the Odyssey yet, actually, but if you recommend it, I shall do that.
I would. It's the language that she uses is almost like very simplified, like very elegant. She drops that like 19th century academic tone of like, this is an important grandiose work and it's epic, that like kind of stuffy shirted grandiosity, and she just keeps it very beautiful and simple and elegant.
The Ursula Le Guin book you mentioned, I looked that up, and yeah, I'm gonna get that because that looks incredible as well.
That was great. It was amazing.
So when you kind of think about adapting a classic, which you've done yourself, like how do you approach that? Do you approach it from the point of view of wanting to share the story or wanting to change it? Or
I think wanting to share it, and then I want to say something like, I want to understand it better. So a lot of times, like, I've made comics, you know, especially if they're autobio comics or whatever, I make them from a place of curiosity or wanting to gain a deeper understanding of a subject or what's going on in my own subconscious. So a lot of like Macbeth was like, I want to delve into this. I want to explore this space. And obviously, like, it takes a long time to make a comic. So part of it is like, I want to spend time with this text. I want to spend a long time with Macbeth and hanging out with all of these people.
And how did you find that with Macbeth? How did you find you liked it more, or was there everything there that you hoped?
Yeah, there was more. Like, obviously I spent a lot of time with him, and there was more in the play than I sort of realized. And yeah, there was also like characters that I didn't like. And obviously there were scenes that I didn't like, and those always took the longest to draw, because I didn't want to spend time with them. And it was great. And it was almost like, it's not a fun story.
It's pretty bleak.
It's pretty bleak. You know, there's murder, mayhem, betrayal, and all kinds of stuff happening. But it was also cathartic. If you want my therapist number or whatever, I can give that to you. But yeah, it was cathartic too.
Yeah, I think one of the main things I took away with it, with reading it that closely a few times, was just how much of a villain he is, really is.
Yeah.
It's very, because he's a title character and he's been played by some very nice actors in the past. It's very easy to kind of be charmed or like at least go along with him to a certain degree and kind of attribute a bit more remorse to him than perhaps he actually shows.
Yeah, and he's the main character. We're used to, as readers, going along with the main character and sympathizing with our main characters. And then when he just starts going to the left, it's very like much sort of like it's disorienting, I guess.
How did you decide what Macbeth would look like?
This is a very practical answer.
Mm-hmm.
So I used myself as the model for Lady Macbeth, for
And
just because
you
I,
do that quite a lot. You bring yourself into a lot of your comics.
and I did it with Lady Macbeth just because I wanted to play Lady Macbeth, and so I used my partner for Macbeth, and it was partially a very practical reason. He's in my house, so whatever reference material I need from him, he's there.
Hold this, stand like
Yes, hold this, stand
that.
like that, pretend you want to kill your best friend, et cetera. Yeah, and so it started from a very like practical place, and then it just made more and more sense to me. Macbeth, I was showing some of the early art to some of my students, my teens, and one of them said, like, that doesn't look like Macbeth. Like that guy, he looks like he would do your taxes. And it was like, yes, perfect. Like evil is mundane. Evil is, yeah, villainry is can be very mundane. So he's just a normal guy who lives with me.
I've got, excuse me, I got quite into the Burbages recently, and particularly Richard Burbage, who was the first actor to ever play Macbeth, and the part was essentially written for him.
Yes.
And he was also the first actor to play Romeo, Hamlet, everybody basically.
That's
And
awesome.
that is kind of, I mean, it's amazing to think that there was an actor who got to play all these parts first, kind of stamp on it in that particular way, and just like most of the character in Macbeth is supposed to be based on him, and there's a good chance that he pretty much directed most of these plays as the main actor and the title character and a massive star. I was just intriguing because I wonder what he looked like
Right.
that he could play all these parts. And it yeah I guess I mean that's acting, but
Yeah.
it doesn't matter, I guess. So let's now have a look at the comic that you chose, and you chose a couple, and yeah, one you've already mentioned, but yeah.
Yeah, I chose I already mentioned Sandman. One that I chose is Swamp Thing, Alan Moore's Swamp Thing specifically, with Bizet is the there's a lot of the art, but yeah, just that, and I'm not even sure I'll be able to put into words like what that comic and Alan Moore's comic, other comics that he's done. A Disease of Language is the other one that is really important to me. It just feels like magic. It just feels like a spell. And the way that Alan Moore takes you on a journey into the green with Swamp Thing, and you feel like you become one with nature, or you feel like you become one with, distant planets. That still like amazes me. That still like knocks me off of my feet. I would love to have like, 10% of that ability to like lead a reader, a viewer through these like impossible, imaginative, amazing, scenarios. Yeah, the other one is the Invisibles. That just I sort of say it like it's self-explanatory. But like maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It's just like, yeah, the Invisibles, I feel like mildly recruited to be an invisible. But it's just everything that those comics.
And that those are both like Grant Morrison and Alan Moore, both similar kinds of writers, and in that they're big intellects,
Yeah,
lots of ideas, and yeah, they kind of drag you into some places you don't really understand.
right. And they're both like, they're magical practitioners. They're using sometimes not, they're using the medium of comics as a part of their practice or as a spell casting medium. That had a big influence. I do that too. Sometimes, like, I'm
Was
also
that
a
coincidental? Did you find kindred spirits, or were you influenced by the fact that they had done it?
It was weird. Like, I was already into all of that stuff, and then it was like, oh, you can use this as a vehicle. You can use this as a spellcasting medium. So yeah, so maybe it was influenced by them.
So can you define that? Explain it a bit for.
Sure. It's like, so I'll just say, like, I liked the term witch. That's what I like to use for myself. But there's one of my works in particular, Triskelion, is this process. It was almost like a spell I was casting on myself to try to heal from trauma. And I started with myself divided. And I was almost like, through the course of the comic, reuniting myself to heal from a trauma. And so through the comics, I am stitching myself back together. Basically, a spell is just your will. You're trying to exercise your will and to get your will in the world. So however you want to do that, I was doing it with throughout the course of my comic. I imagined and visualized and drew myself meeting this goal. And yeah, if that makes sense. Sorry, I feel like I was rambling a bit.
No,
Okay.
That makes sense. It makes
Okay.
sense. And on like a very basic level, like Steve Bissett's artwork in Swamp Thing does like, as soon as I heard that, I was like, okay, yeah, I can kind of see there's a bit of influence going on there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the maximalism, I guess, if you want to call it that.
And now that when you mentioned Sandman as well, of course, it made me think of Dave McKean's covers for the individual issues, which I think I've heard you talk about Dave McKean before, and I assume he's a big influence too in the more collagey aspects of what you
Yeah,
do.
absolutely. The whole, like, whatever, if it's not nailed down, use it. Like, it's, you don't have to be, yeah. That was a revolution, especially like going through traditional art school, where there's a lot of talk about what materials you use and using archival everything and the best possible this, that, and the other. And you look at McKean's work and it's like a broken clock, some masking tape, a smear. And it's like, okay, great.
Okay, and then finally we had TV show.
Sure.
So yeah, you gave me two. One that you said had a big impact on your work, and one that had an impact on you as a human being.
Yeah.
So I think it's best that they're the way round that they are. If it'd been the other way around, that could have been bad, really.
That would be scary. So,
Yep.
listener, the two options are Star Trek: The Next Generation and Twin Peaks. So you can guess which one.
Depends what day it is.
Right, what day it is. So yeah, Star Trek: The Next Generation definitely had an impact on me as a human. I remember watching it as it came out, in the late 80s and early 90s. Yeah, as it was just coming across on network TV, and seeing, again, like, imagined worlds, like the escapism and the women doing cool, awesome things as a child, like Deanna Troi and yeah, Crusher and all that stuff, and Tasha Yar, like they're in there, they're doing stuff, which has made an impact on me as a child. And the paragon of non-toxic masculinity, Captain Jean-Luc Picard himself, like, he did it. He's there. He's amazing. He's something to
And
aspire to.
played Macbeth as well.
And played Macbeth, a very nice and lovely person,
Mm-hmm.
playing an awful person. But yeah, and then Twin Peaks is just the influence on the art, like the connection to nature, and nature and the natural world sort of infiltrating the civilized world. It's woodsy, it's weird, it's steeped in mythology that's real and a mythology that David Lynch just comes up with, which I love. And the fact that it's like delving into the subconscious and bringing up all of the gloopy bits. That's definitely something that I try to do, like on the page, with the characters. They'll be, you know, they'll be up front and they'll be saying their lines and talking, and then behind them, I usually try to put in something about what is going on in the internal landscape.
And the magic as well, magic.
And the magic, like, yeah. Yes. And the magic, yes.
What did you think of Twin Peaks: The Return?
I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. It's especially the final. It was incredible.
Yeah. And like, again, I had one of those moments watching episode 8, which, you know, the one with Judy coming into the world, and like, yeah, like I'll always remember where I was, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably the greatest TV show of all time. It's it's had a big influence on me as well, that show. It's just what you can do with that art form, and
yeah,
what they do with it, and the fact, and then again with The Return, how they change it, but it's the same, and it's yeah, and the darkness, and there are just images that will never leave my head from that show.
Yeah.
But also hilarious and yeah, beautiful and yeah, and yeah, the music and yeah, incredible. Yeah, and I think Star Trek is really interesting, especially Next Generation. It's kind of, I feel like it's been really influential on a lot of cartoonists. I hear a lot of Next Generation talk amongst comics people, and I personally was a Doctor Who fan, and we didn't do Star Trek too much. Like, I like it, but I never like love Star Trek. But I might actually go back and rewatch. I might start from the beginning at some point and watch it all. Does it bear rewatching?
It does. I don't know. Well, I don't know. I feel like
does it end well?
Well, I mean, not everyone is gonna like the ending, for any TV show. But like, I remember liking it, but I was like a kid. I think it's always hard to be like, yes, you should watch this show that was a really formative experience for me as a child.
Yeah.
Because like, it's the first like season or two, it's like the production value is pretty low and they don't know exactly what the vibe is yet. But then they get into some really good stuff, and like, it's Star Trek. So they're questioning the meaning of life and what does it mean to be a human? And what is our place in the universe, and what are our values? And they just have jumped ahead in time, and they don't explain to you how. But it's just like, yeah, nobody uses money anymore. We have replicators and people are cool with gender and it's not a big deal. And we've just gotten over it as a society.
So, I feel like that was fairly successful. I might do that again. I feel like the comics in media thing works.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. What's in your comics future? What's next for you?
That is a good question. I don't know. I'm not really sure like how to like approach it or talk about it, but like, I'm experiencing creative burnout and I don't feel the compulsion or the urge to make comics like I have in the past. So I'm almost like taking a minute to like come to terms with like who I am as a creative person. So that's kind of what's on the menu. It's going to be an interesting and challenging and fraught process, basically. And then, I mean, it's just weird to know that like I'm experiencing this burnout, and I also have like some ideas about what I could do. So it's like, no, don't just jump into the next thing. Like, feel your feelings, stuff like that. And that's what's next for me, is feeling.
and then medieval Batman.
Yes.
Just skip past all the kind of feeling stuff and deciding what to do. Just get to where you're going already.
Just get back to medieval Batman jumping off of cathedrals and punching jesters in the face.
That's going to be perfect. Perfect. Finally, if you could recommend one comic that everyone should go out and read, what would it be? Ooh, I sprung that on you.
Oh, God. Yeah, you did. The Invisibles.
Okay.
I say so. I would say The Invisibles, first answer, best answer. But then, like, sort of other ones that have been, like, pretty impactful for me because, like, This Woman's Work, and I can't remember her name, which is the worst. I can see the title.
Is it Julie?
Yes.
Duquette?
Yep, Julie Duquette. Julie Duquette. I read that a little bit ago, and it's just, like, stuck with me. And I had, like, a really important moment sitting with that. Yeah. I think The Invisibles, yes. You might hate it, but it's an experience.
I think I'm trying to remember if I think I did start reading it at one point, but there was too much going on, but I do want to go back to it. I mean, it looks amazing. I am a Grant Morrison fan, but yeah.
Okay. I think what you need to keep in mind is, like, it came out before The Matrix, so, like, it is not ripping off The Matrix.
Yeah.
I don't know how to put that. Yeah, it's old. So, yeah.
Cool. Pre-Matrix, pre-Matrix.
Pre-Matrix, pre-Matrix.
Cool. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Briggs.
Thank you so much for having me.